Let's go to our weekly look at New Zealand crimes. And today, possibly the most infamous crime in New Zealand history, the murder of the Bain family in Dunedin just over 25 years ago. David Bain spent 13 years in prison after being found guilty of killing his parents and three of his siblings in 1994. However, he always maintained his innocence and he was acquitted in a retrial in 2009. We're joined today by senior staff reporter Martin van Beinen, who covered the retrial for The Press and later produced a podcast called Black Hands, which some of you may have listened to. It's a very popular podcast. Martin, hello.
Hello there, Juicy.
Thanks for your time today. How are you doing in the bubble, by the way?
Oh, I've had a very nice lockdown. Thanks, Juicy.
Pleased to hear it. Okay, take us back to when you first came across this case.
Well, I was just like any other New Zealander at the time of the actual murders and just watched it from afar. I think we did send a reporter down to cover it. I was then working for the press. And it wasn't until about 97 that I started to get involved, mainly by reviewing some of the books that came out at the time. And one was about one was by James McNeish, and the other one was by Joe Karam. So I got to know some of the arguments and some of the personalities involved, and that was really my introduction to it. And then I sort of kept tabs on it. In 2009, I was the main reporter for the press and stuff on the Bain trial, and yes, and then I covered every day of the 58-day trial. And then a couple of years later, I started writing a book about it.
And the book, I understand, is currently sort of what, on hold?
Well, no, the book is being picked up by Penguin.
Great.
And so that will be published at a date as yet to be fixed, mainly because there are still some issues that to go through, but no, I'm happy to report that the book will finally be published, and that was the basis of the podcast, and also the basis of the drama series that Warner Brothers are filming at the moment.
Yeah, the reason I asked you about the book was I think there was initially some nervousness. Or some nervousness from the initial publisher around the legal implications. So I'm glad you found an outlet for it, for us. And we'll chat about the TV show too if we get time at the end of this chat. But where shall we begin? Should we go back to 1994 and exactly what we know happened and what we don't know?
Okay, well, I'd have to bring you back to a sort of fairly bleak, dark, cold morning on June the 20th, 1994, and the first the world knew about it was a phone call that David made to 111, and he reported that his family was dead, and this was about 7:09 in the morning. He had come back from his paper run and found his family dead, shot, and and it really went from there. The police arrived.
In fact, sorry to interrupt, we actually do have the audio from that 111 call, so maybe now is a good time to play it. This is from
sure.
RNZ Insight. This is the 111 call that David Bain made on that morning.
Help me, help. They're all dead.
What's the matter?
They're all dead. I came home and they're all dead.
Whereabouts are you?
Every street. 65 Every Street. They're all dead.
Who's all dead?
My family, they're all dead. Hurry up.
It's okay. Every Street. What number are you calling from?
454.
Mm-hmm.
2527.
454.
2527.
2527. And your last name?
Bain.
Bain.
That's quite incredible to listen to that, isn't
it?
I'm sure you've heard it plenty of times. Anything strike you about that call?
Well, there are so many little stories attached to that call. I mean, some there was obviously the first thing that strikes you is the sort of the sceptical attitude of the call taker, and that was a guy called Tom Dempsey, who was a St. John ambulance employee, and he was in the call centre taking calls. And afterwards, he remarked that he never met anybody, never experienced anybody who was able to give the details so accurately and concisely, without sort of going into being affected by all the trauma. So yeah, some people would say that that's a very distressed David, and other people would say that is David acting. And of course, the police before the trial in 2009, they were going through the call, and they found one of the detectives thought he heard David say something during the call or under his breath, and that became a massive issue. Went right to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, "Well, no, we can't use that evidence. The police can't use that evidence." And essentially, the police were saying that David sort of uttered under his breath the words, "I shot the prick," or something like that, and that became, that was just another.
In that call we just heard then?
Yeah.
Mm. Have you listened to it carefully and to see if you can?
I've listened to it very carefully, and I sort of agree with the Supreme Court. I think if you're told what he's supposed to have said, you can probably hear it.
Mm.
But I think I just think it's too sketchy.
Yeah. What part of the call does it come in, by the way?
I can't remember. I think it's where he's asked about his phone number or his address, something like that.
Mm. Okay. Can you? I suppose we better talk about who was in his family as well, the context and who he's talking about there. So can you tell us about the Bain family?
All right. Yes. Well, there were five bodies found in the house. And if we just could talk about the parents first. So David's father was Robin, and he was 58, and he was a gifted teacher, ahead of his time in some respects, because he was very good with computers. He was good with te reo and Māori cultural performances. And he was loved by his community. He was a real asset to the Tairi Beach community, and the parents really, really valued the fact that they had this gifted teacher in their community. Unfortunately, Robin was a bit of a shambles otherwise. He hated paperwork, and his office was a mess. He lived in a caravan at home. He wouldn't sleep in the house, and also at school he sort of lived out of his old van. Interesting character. Gentle. People say that he was very gentle and serious, but also with a wicked sense of humour. And then we have Margaret. Now, Margaret was a big personality. She was a devoted mother. But in some ways, she was a very angry, sort of resentful woman. She felt that family deserved better, and her spiritual life was slightly bizarre. She thought she had a direct line with God, and saw the devil everywhere. Very devoted to the family, but she still spent a lot of time in bed watching videos.
So not a particularly functional, not a particularly functional marriage then at that point.
No, the marriage had been in trouble for a long time, and Margaret wanted Robin gone. She wanted him out of the family. Robin hung in there. It was a bit of a spiritual war between them two. I mean, Margaret wanted Robin to buy into her beliefs, whereas Robin was really a traditional Presbyterian and sort of bore the tensions at home stoically, but but he didn't succumb. He was a sort of a trench fighter. He just sort of kept his head down, but he stuck to his guns. And then, of course, we have David.
Yeah.
Four children, yeah. So the oldest was David. He was 22 at the time of the murders, and he was an interesting character. He was quite talented. He was a talented singer. He was a good runner. He was a good dancer, and he had lots going for him, except many people saw him as a sort of a geeky, nerdy guy, big, tall guy with big ears. He had no real friends, and he had a funny manner, apparently, according to some people. They thought he was a bit over the top, a bit needy, and a bit over-friendly. So that was David. Very few people thought he was capable of doing anything like the things that he was accused of later. And then Ara was 19. She was really the star of the family. She was sort of had strong moral principles, was a good Christian girl, and a very talented teacher, incredibly hard worker. And I really have not heard anybody talk about her in anything other than very, very glowing terms. Again, you know, talented girl, musically, and just a really nice personality, very highly regarded by everyone. Then we have Lani, and she was 18. She was another interesting character. She struggled at school, she struggled academically, and sort of craved attention and affection. Very much like her mother in some ways, people say. Anyway, she clashed with Margaret, and there were issues with smoking and drugs and drinking and that sort of thing. And she rebelled, left school, and found herself on the outside and living in the community with no real income. And she became a prostitute, still maintaining some contact with the family, it should be said. She wasn't sort of banished altogether, and Robin would pay some of her bills, and it was, I think, the family helped her with her rent and things like that. So there was still quite a lot of contact between them. David and Aral would go and see her and that sort of thing. So, she wasn't totally estranged. And then we have Stephen.
Sorry, just to clarify, was she living in the house at that time, or did she just happen to be there on that night?
She just happened to be there that night, GC. She had actually left home about a year before, and she was she had two residences. One was with her father out at the school, and it gets complicated, but a couple of months before the murders, Robin was offered the schoolhouse, which had previously been occupied. So all of a sudden he had a new home out by the school, and Lania went to live with him, but she also retained her. She had a room in a boarding house in Russell Street, which wasn't far from Central Dunedin. But on the night of the murders, she was home, partly, I think, because she was starting a new job the next day, and she needed to get up early, and I think this was, probably a little more convenient for her.
Okay, and then one more for you to introduce us to.
Yes, Stephen. Well, Stephen was 14, and he was a wiry, gutsy kid. Played the trumpet at school. Had a lot of friends. He was a real live wire, and a bit of a scrapper. Unlike David, he wouldn't take any crap from anyone, and so he was a bit of a handful, I think, but a good kid, good-hearted, and popular at school. So that's the family. And
so we heard the 111 call. We know that what did the police find when they got there?
Well, they found the five members of the family dead. There was no sign of any life at all. Stephen and Ara were out of bed and lying on the floor with their you know, having died from their injuries. Margaret and Alania were in bed, had been shot in bed and remained in bed. And Robin was in the front room with the rifle beside him and lying on his side with one bullet wound in his head, making police think immediately this was a murder-suicide, so that Robin shot the family and then himself while David was out on his paper run.
Mm. There was a computer message as well, which is probably worth mentioning.
Yes, so this message was on the computer. It said, "Sorry, you are the only one who deserved to stay." So this was supposedly Robin telling David, "Look, I'm sorry, but you are the one who deserved to stay." So yeah, a strange thing to do, a man deciding to take his own life and deciding to write a last message. So he goes to the computer and writes what is a fairly cryptic message, apparently to David. But the police would later say that that was David just trying to make it look as though Robin was the killer.
Yeah, when did they start thinking along those lines? When did they get the sense that it might not be so straightforward?
It's a bit hard to say, but at least by, I think, the second or third day of the inquiry, so this was, the murder was on the Monday. By the Wednesday, I think, they were starting to wonder if it wasn't Robin, maybe even earlier. I think David was always the suspect. And slowly things started to, yes, things didn't add up. And there was always, David's initial problem was that he couldn't explain why he had taken so long to ring the police. Because when he got home about 6:40, 6:45, he didn't ring the police until 7:09. So that's 25 minutes. Now, what did he do during those 25 minutes? And that was what he could fill in a little bit of that time, but he couldn't fill in the whole time. In fact, most of it. So that made the police wonder, well, what did you do during those 25 minutes? And made them, yeah, that sort of raised suspicions. And then on the Thursday night, the police found a lens in Stephen's room. Now, the lens was from some spectacles, the frame of which was found in David's room. So the frame was found on a chair in David's room, and beside the frame was the other lens. So the question was, well, how did the lens get into Stephen's room where there was the fight? And that's really the key to the whole case. The key to the case is the fight with Stephen. The killer had to have had some signs of being in that fight. And it was a brutal fight, you know, sort of swirled around the room. Stephen had horrendous amount of injuries and cuts and abrasions and that sort of thing. So the killer would have sustained some damage. And one thing that fits into that is the lens, because the glasses, the spectacles frame was damaged, and so it looked as though it may have been in a fight. But, you know, that was one strand of the circumstantial evidence against David. Probably not enough to even charge him, but very interesting nonetheless.
What did police think David's motive would be? Or I mean, we might as well hop into that first trial of David and, you know, what was the motive as stated by police there?
Look, because the police don't have to prove motive, they it wasn't a big part of the trial. I mean, obviously mm-hmm. it helps to convince the jury that person is guilty. Yeah. Give the jury a good reason why the accused has committed the crime, but it's not one of the elements that the Crown have to prove. So it doesn't necessarily become a big part of the case. But this is one of the fascinating things about the Bain case, is that David's supporters have always said, look, this is a young man who had absolutely no motive to to kill his family. In fact, his whole life was ahead of him. He was a talented guy. He was starting a relationship, and things were starting to look up for him. So that was the defense view, that David had absolutely no motive. A lovely guy, humorous, kind, and would never have killed his family. The police really didn't put forward any real, really strong motive. I think they alluded to the fact that David they hated his father, and was very, very close to his mother, and it sort of went from there. I could think of 100 different motives for David, you know, putting on my hat as an amateur psychologist. But at the end of the day, we don't know. We don't know if David was the killer. We don't know why he did it, and we never really do we? We don't. Like, generally speaking, mass killers don't tell us exactly why they do it. I'm thinking of these mass killers who commit suicide after they've done their terrible deed. So motive is always going to be difficult. I think if we look at David, you'd have to look at his very close relationship to his mother. Then we look at his, this was a woman who was seeing the devil everywhere, and had this idea that they would set up this refuge, sort of retreat, at 65 Every Street. David was on board there. David was. So you combine a couple of those things, and you start to think, yes, David was looking at more failure in the future. It's hard to know. As for Robin, the defence argument there was that Robin was sort of at his wit's end. His career was on the rocks. He was depressed, distressed about, being pushed out of the family. And of course, the clincher was this evidence that Lani was telling everybody that he had molested her or had a sort of incest with her, and that was going to come out. And Robin knew that, and he snapped and took the family with him. So those are the two opposing theories on the motive.
And on what evidence was David Bain convicted?
The main points that he had to answer, and again, I don't know why the two juries came to different verdicts, but David's the main hard evidence against David, according to the Crown, was based around about five or six different things. One was the fact that he had Stephen's blood on his clothes, and both on his T-shirt, on his shorts, and on his socks. And then he had injuries which suggested he might have been in a fight. He had three or four bruises on his head, and he had scratch marks on his chest that looked as though someone might have scraped his chest. His fingerprints were found on the rifle, the murder weapon, and the fingerprints had been placed on there by the blood going on the fingers first, and then it was placed on the rifle. And that was suspicious because the rifle was smeared in blood, but the spaces between David's fingerprints were clear of any smearing. Then we have the lens, which I've already mentioned. And we have the delay again in calling the police, which I've already talked about, and also and David also said that he heard Laniet gurgling. Now, the argument there is that if Laniet was gurgling, she still had to be alive. So the person who heard her gurgling had to be the person who delivered the final shots that killed her. And then the sort of the second arm of the Crown case was that there was very little evidence against Robin. Like there were no his fingerprints weren't on the rifle, and he had none of the children's or his wife's blood on his clothes when he was found dead. So it gave them a terrible problem. They had to explain why Robin would shoot the family, change his clothes. And they weren't, you know, he didn't change into his best suit. He changed into some raggedy old clothes and then shot himself after having put the bloody clothes from the murders in the washing and the laundry. So that was always going to be a bit of a stumbling block for the defence. Now, and if you want, shall I go on to the defence case?
Yeah, it's such a fascinating case. I thought we'd have plenty of time for it. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. So give us the good stuff.
Well, I better cover the defence case because they said Robin did have signs of being involved in the murders. He had some small injuries on his hands, which suggests that he may have been in a fight. And they had an expert witness who said there were some bruises on his fingers, which may have been caused by a punch. But on the other hand, they could have been caused by lots of other things as well. And then the defence said all of the evidence that the Crown was alleging against David had explanations. They could explain it. There were other possibilities. So they tried to undermine every single element that I've talked about, and to a certain extent they must have succeeded because the jury in the second trial acquitted David. One of the important defence points was the sock prints that were found in the house, and they said that the sock prints were too small for David. He wouldn't have made them. They were made by bloodied socks. So the defence said, well, Robin, David couldn't have made them because his feet are too big, but they were exactly right for Robin. So that put Robin in Margaret's bedroom and in the hallway, and where he could never have been if he was innocent. So the sock prints became a huge issue, both for Justice Binney when he did his compensation review and of course in the trial.
Maybe we should then conclude with your opinion piece, because in the retrial the jury acquitted David Bain, and you wrote an opinion piece saying that you disagreed with their decision. What was your argument in that?
Well, essentially I said the evidence against David was individually, you know, the 6 or 7 elements were individually not enough to convict David. But when you put them all together, they were an extremely strong case. And the fact that they all existed, that they actually made up this rope, made it very difficult for David to explain away. The fact that they were all there together and all pointing to him would mean that he's incredibly unlucky if in fact he's innocent. And the other main argument I had was that I just couldn't see that Robin, there was just no convincing evidence that Robin was involved. In fact, everything really points to Robin being completely innocent, and that you have to stretch all the evidence to put him in the picture. So I just thought, well, on balance, I mean, I could see perhaps how a jury might come up, might have a reasonable doubt, but to say David is innocent is sort of flies in the face of common sense.
This is, and by the way, if you just tuned in, this is the opinion of Martin Van Beinen, who is our guest today, talking through this New Zealand true crime. We should stress too that David Bain has always maintained his innocence and was in fact acquitted and received compensation.
Can I just stop you there? Yeah. Can I just stop you there? It wasn't compensation. He was given a payment because of the length of the compensation process and all the various expense and he incurred during that. So the Crown said, we're not giving you compensation, but if let's just put this to bed, we'll give you $925,000, I think it was, and you won't take it any further. And that was sort of a fairly pragmatic deal done. So David did get some money, and the Crown could wash its hands off the whole thing.
Yes, apologies, and happy to be corrected on that. Martin, thanks for spending some time talking through this case with us. There'll be lots of people looking forward to the TV show based on your book and on your podcast, so looking forward to that on our screens, and thanks very much for the time today.
My pleasure, Jesse.